Welcome to Supersized Science, where we feature research and discoveries nationwide, enabled by advanced computing technology and expertise at the Texas Advanced Computing Center of the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Jorge Salazar, a science writer at Tech. Decades of research in high-performance computing, or HPC, gave rise to today's supercomputer. And in turn, HPC laid the foundation for the emergence of artificial intelligence, AI. It's been a busy two-way street. The immense market impact of AI is driving technologies scientists use for simulation. HPC is harnessing AI in an accurate and uncompromising way for scientific applications, which take advantage of AI's power and economic efficiencies and have led to innovations across various sectors like research, manufacturing, healthcare, and more. What's more, HPC in the U.S. continues to fuel technological advancements and contributes to the growth of specialized industries, creating new jobs and boosting overall economic output. On the podcast to discuss how AI is being put to work for science is Dan Stanzione, Executive Director of TAC and Associate Vice President for Research at UT Austin. Dr. Stanzione, thank you for speaking with us today.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Jorge.
Could you speak to what does AI owe to high-performance computing?
Yeah, so it's a great question. AI in its current form has sort of sprung on the public consciousness in the last 5 years with chatbots, ChatGPT, stuff like that. But that really wasn't the starting point. It's really developed over almost 70 years now since the term artificial intelligence was defined. And I remember, for instance, when I took a class in neural networks, right, the basis of the deep learning models we use for AI now, in graduate school, which for me was, 34 years ago, we were using very similar techniques of, building neural networks, but we could only do a few at a time because of the lack of computing capability that we had back then. And so they weren't able to do any of the sort of amazing things that you can see now, right? You might be able to do some basic feature distinguishing. And in the last 30 years, there's been sort of two trends of parallel tracks of progress, right? One is how we build really big and fast computer systems has been sort of the HPC world. And then the AI researchers were also still studying algorithms and network architectures and stuff like that. But it was really not until 2012, 2014, we started having computer systems that could do real things. And you started seeing things like, IBM's chess system beating chess people, and then ultimately ChatGPT. And now this explosion of applications built around essentially generative AI and large language models. In that interim, there's a ton of stuff that came really out of the academic HPC community as much as the industry that's really driven that from our whole ballgame has been take a bunch of commodity computing components and build really big and fast, tightly coupled computers. And that's exactly what they need to build large AI systems now, right? So if you look at modern commercial data centers, they're built around liquid cooling for high density GPUs. We've been doing liquid cooling attack. I think our first system went in to directly liquid cool processors over 10 years ago. At this point. And so that the HPC industry has had a ton to do with bringing that forward. There's been low latency interconnects like InfiniBand was designed for HPC in 1999, right? And it's now the dominant technology for interconnecting things in AI. The message passing that we, first defined in open source standard in the mid 90s for supercomputing, dominant paradigm for AI now when you start talking across multiple GPUs. Even the notion of using GPUs for parallel processing, what's all AI runs on now, right? These are chips that were originally designed for graphics, and then they became for programmable graphics in the early 2000s. And the start of general purpose GPU, it was actually defined at the University of North Carolina, that term, GPGPU, in around 2002, I believe, when people started using those graphics processors to do science, because it was cheaper and faster than using conventional processors if you'd put in the software work. And it's evolved from there to where we don't even say GPGPU anymore, which was general purpose graphics processing unit. We just say GPUs, and everybody assumes it means an AI processor. But it was built for graphics, adapted in the scientific community, and then with a lot of help from NVIDIA for general purpose computing, and then has become the default way we do AI now.
Could you speak to the impact that AI has had on the technologies that scientists use now to help simulate nature, to understand some things that are not possible otherwise?
Yeah, so we're seeing the incorporation of AI in a whole bunch of different ways in sort of the general scientific workflows, ranging from things like surrogate models, where we're actually pulling out the sort of math and physics-based models for, say, weather forecasting or something like that, and you replace it with a trained surrogate model that's just looked at a lot of data and is emulating or predicting what's going on based on the data that it's seen in the past. And those work relatively effectively. I mean, for really important decisions, you'd probably still want to do a physics-based model, but maybe you, instead of looking at, you know, if I'm trying to find the optimal design point for the shape of an aircraft wing, instead of trying 100,000 simulations with different parameters, I'll let AI sort through the 100,000, give me the 50 best ones, and then I'll run real physics-based simulations of those to verify that what the AI thinks is the best choice is the best choice. We see a lot of these sort of AI-guided optimizations and everything from drug design to specification of machine parts and things like that. Materials design is a pretty popular one right now. We see the, you know, I mentioned the use of surrogates. We also see it sort of in the steps that aren't traditionally simulation-driven, like mining all the literature to find what the best, you know, sort of build the database of what do we know and what are the most promising directions for if you're looking at, say, a given gene for cancer or a given material for a solar cell. There might be thousands to millions of papers you need to sift through to figure out sort of what's been done and where there's promising evidence and where you want to go next. So AI is really good at those kinds of steps. And then there's various other things, using AI to help you do interpolation. So we can run coarse grain simulations and refine them to fine grain. So skipping time steps, skipping length steps, and letting the AI infer the difference. So there's going to be some degree of sort of computation, traditional computation that gets replaced by AI. It's never going to all go away because we really need to verify, you know, before you drive over a bridge, you probably want us to have run the physics to make sure that bridge is going to keep standing and not just blindly trust the AI model on it. Some amount of our physics-based simulation will get replaced with AI, and some amount will sort of coexist with it in the future.
Given the scale of private investment, which has been huge in the tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars annually, where can public investment still have impact?
That's really a fascinating topic, and it sort of harkens back to your first question of how decades of development in HPC have led to sort of the modern AI industry, along with decades of research in artificial intelligence, right? And sort of most technologies hit a certain tipping point where they're commercially viable and the market can take it, scale up, and run. And that's happened with generative AI, for instance, and large language models, where, as you mentioned, right, there's hundreds of billions of dollars in private investment building big models. But I think there's a few important things to think about here. One is, first of all, the innovations that got us to that point came out of public investment, right, and open academic research that had to get to a certain point before industry can run. And that pipeline of new innovations keeps happening, not only in the next round of discoveries, but in AI itself. There's a ton of things that happen in the private sector that are sort of taking the technologies and just running with them, throwing the most possible money at it to build the biggest models and things like that. And we're probably not in a position where building the biggest model is a good public investment or academic pursuit at this point. But a real example of how you can use less infrastructure to make big changes is the DeepSeek model that came out of China just a few months ago at the time we're taping this, where just paying a lot of attention to optimization and putting some really smart people working hard on making the code better. And, you know, they didn't do anything sort of radically different in terms of the science. They just looked at where can we optimize? Where can we make the data better? Where can we tweak the training algorithms? What can we put best on the GPUs and CPUs in the right ways? And they made sort of an order of magnitude improvement, right? Which, you know, means instead of maybe spending $100 billion in infrastructure, you can spend $10 billion on infrastructure. And that's a huge impact that came from a bunch of people working that didn't cost anywhere near $1 billion, right, to do. There's also the fact that, you know, just in the application of AI, right, the private sector is going to drive, you know, bigger and better large language models that will consume and need a lot of infrastructure to do that. But they're going to target it focused on the problems that are the most profitable, right? So steering you the best ads, right? Chatbots they can sell you to help out, right? They're not going to necessarily, without a bunch more research coming from the open side, target them at problems like you have a rare disease and we need a treatment for that rare disease, but there's not 80 million patients to make it profitable. That's going to be something that's going to stay in the academic research side, right? Things that are long range or very basic that don't have a near-term return. We need public funding to figure out how to apply AI in those scenarios, right, that aren't at this point short-term profitable until we get them to the point where they can be. And that's been just like nobody who's building mobile apps has to worry about how wireless communications work or how to get a long-lasting battery on a cell phone, right? Those are all things that have translated from the basic research pipeline into the product pipeline and are now just refined by industry so that everybody assumes mobile phones work and have an operating system. And that's created all this economic activity around building apps and everything else, right? So that comes from that. But none of that happens without the basic research upstream. And if we ever turn off that tap, it's going to be devastating in the long term.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the opportunities out there in the development of software and hardware for AI and the technological opportunities of AI now for that could benefit scientists and ultimately taxpayers who fund this research?
Yeah, there's sort of endless examples, right? I think, you know, there's the fundamental enhancements we make in the AI algorithms themselves, right? How to do it better, how to do it cheaper, how to do it faster, that makes AI itself more sophisticated over time. And there's, again, a huge amount of that going on. There's also, again, as I mentioned, the sort of translational piece of how do we use it to do different things. We've gotten to where if you want to stand up a chatbot, we're really good at that, right? If you want to stand up, you know, a steadily more sophisticated chatbot that maybe can look at imagery or spoken voice instead of text. If you want to look at, there's some video analysis that works pretty well now. There's a number of things that it's sort of commercially good at that are easy to do. It's still hard to say, I don't want to base my AI on the current model and Torch for tensors, right? Which is the way everything is built right now. You know, if you wanted to build it any other way, you know, there's still a lot of work to do there. And even figuring out if the networks that we're using are the right kinds of networks, right? So they're sort of a loose analogy to the human brain. Arguably, superintelligence will require different models if you want to surpass the human brain. There's a lot of issues around security around that and being able to explain answers. Again, if you're going to use it for a decision that might kill you, you know, what is your cancer therapy? What is the design of the aircraft you're about to step on to fly you at hundreds of miles an hour at 30,000 feet in the air? We need to understand how it's arriving at those conclusions and what backs them up, right? And so that's a huge topic of research right now. And again, just hits across so many applications, I can't even count them all. But things AI are not good at yet are a lot of the quantitative stuff. How do you look at a population of people with, say, diabetes and say that what are the markers in a given person that indicate that this treatment will work and this treatment won't work, right? That's a great problem that AI can, in theory, tackle, but it's not trivial to do at this point, right? Is it genomic information that it needs to understand? Is it proteomic information that it needs to understand? Does it need scans of your body to figure that out, right? There's just so many things we need to explore in so many of those spaces, right? Healthcare is a great example that sort of everybody can relate to, but it's going to be in autonomous vehicles, another great example, you know, self-driving cars, improving out how all that works, how we integrate different kinds of sensors into those to make them work better. How do we make them cooperate to work better? You know, how do we put the proper guardrails to make sure they don't do the wrong thing? But, you know, there's all sorts of other things, right, that could be how do we find better materials for 3D printing that might affect how we're going to do construction and manufacturing in the future? There's just, like I said, really an endless set of examples in what it could do because, you know, we're sort of 5 to 7 years into the generative AI age when we were 5 years into the digital computer age, you know, 1950. You know, we had computers that you couldn't dream of the range of applications we put them to now, right? Nobody was sending cat videos and via computer in 1950. So there will be an equal blossoming and sort of maturation of AI in terms of applications, basic technologies, derived technologies from it that we probably can't even imagine at this point.
So how is tech helping scientists use AI in their research now?
There's a few aspects to that. The most obvious one is we have big compute platforms, so we can run big models on a lot of them. And we have our Vista supercomputer, which is mostly GPU-focused around Hoppers, that were the 2024 state-of-the-art in GPUs. We're going to be hopefully deploying a system this fall around Blackwells, which is the 2025 state-of-the-art in GPUs. We have hundreds to thousands of them, depending on which version you're talking about. So we provide an enormous platform for people to run on and a lot of data sets for people to access sort of inside our infrastructure. We're also providing a lot of human support, right? Building out the packages, helping them build the packages. They need the latest version of the Llama model, the Falcon model, the OpenAI model, the Mistral model, take your pick, the special image classification model. Some of those are being trained here. Some of those are being retrained here for specific purposes. Some of them we're just running for inference. So we've built some inference-specific hardware so you can just use those models instead of building them. And we support both things inside of our infrastructure. but certainly a lot of software help in tuning. So we have a bunch of staff members paying attention to this too, and both how to tune, how to make them run better across our systems. And it's something, you know, we do a lot of training around how to do that as well. We're trying to help sort of up and down the stack from just being the machines to do it to the knowledge to be able to use the machines are all things that sort of TAC stays involved in.
What's important for people to know about TAC's newest project, the U.S. National Science Foundation's Leadership Class Computing Facility that's currently being built in Round Rock, Texas?
Yeah, so, well, the facility is being built in a lot of places. The main data center will be in Round Rock for the biggest systems that are part of it, which we're doing with a partner in Sabi Data Centers, who's helping us build out the space. They've built the building. They're now customizing the space for us so that we can move in the kind of infrastructure that we want to run, the very most modern, super dense. And assuming federal budgets hold up, you know, we'll be deploying thousands of new GPUs there to do exaops of AI capability, 10 to the 18th power AI operations per second, probably a factor of 100 better than our last really big systems. The individual nodes will be two or three times better than our current Vista system, and there'll be a lot more of them. So we can do both, you know, single jobs faster and a lot greater scale. And it also helps us sustain the staff that supports all this, you know, to build out the software stacks that we need to help people get their models running, you know, on those machines and use them effectively. We're also building out a bunch of storage to store all the data associated, either generated by these or to help train them without having to go grab petabytes of cancer data off the internet every single time you want to do one of these, which would take weeks and months. It'll just be sitting local to the compute. You know, the idea is to build, you know, really a sort of science-focused AI factory, you know, around this stuff to help continue this transition of AI for science.
What are some ways that TAC is using its technology and expertise to help society with urgent computing in areas such as discovering new medicines and natural disasters?
So we've always done a lot of what I've called urgent computing work, I think has become the sort of popular term, but things where the turnaround time matters an awful lot, right? You know, if we're studying how the universe was formed, we've had several billion years to do that. Hopefully we have at least a few more to figure that out. It's not, you know, but if you have a hurricane forming in the Gulf and it's going to hit the coast in 72 hours, any forecasts that take longer than that are just irrelevant, right? That's not a forecast anymore, right? That's a hindcast. We have a lot of these things with real-time or near-real-time constraints, right? Modeling wildfires, modeling earthquakes, modeling the impacts of them, modeling how buildings respond in the face of floods and high winds and earthquakes and fires and, you know, improving building codes, improving building materials. They're sort of our steady work in healthcare, right? There's the sort of constant crisis, you might call it, around cancer, Alzheimer's, things like that. But when there are things like COVID that pop up and we need to respond quickly with drug discovery pipelines, which are all AI-aided at this point, still have molecular dynamics in them, but a lot of AI as well. Those are things that we can quickly pivot our resources to, mostly because we have worked with the researchers doing that work for a long time. The tools are ready and they're there. And between disasters, we're improving the software, improving the skills of the people doing it and the infrastructure to run it on so that we're ready when those things happen to respond quickly. And it's been AI incorporation into tsunami prediction is a big one now, looking at the West Coast, right? If there's a big earthquake off the Pacific coast, I think on the major fault line, you know, the waves will hit Seattle in about 26 minutes, right? So deciding if you, from the time you detect an earthquake, if there's going to be a wave, is it going to be a significant wave? Do you need to do anything about it? You have a couple of minutes to make those decisions if you want to give people 20 minutes to respond to, you know, if you're in Seattle, go uphill. You know, really life-critical decisions that seconds matter. And so our ability to run them quickly and optimize and spend time on those techniques so that it's just, say, inferencing from an AI model instead of starting from ground zero every time you have an earthquake detection. You sort of have pre-computed it if you have a trained model. That really helps us respond quickly.
Can you talk about some emerging trends in supercomputing, such as quantum computing, edge computing that TAC is interested in and is supporting? And how are these trends likely to impact the future of supercomputing?
Yeah, I think, you know, edge computing is an area that we see a ton of growth in right now. And it raises a lot of interesting research questions, right? And so edge computing just means what happens on a remote device versus in a data center, in essence, right? And that can be a tiny little device, a little processor that costs 10 cents that's hooked to a stream flow sensor looking at flooding, you know, along a riverbank or a stream flow. It can be the processor in your autonomous vehicle communicating with the system that's predicting, are there traffic things up ahead it needs to know about in advance, right? So, and what route should it take and things like that. So in almost all of these problems, you have to sort of decide what is the partitioning you want to do between, you know, where you acquire the data and where and what computing you do on it, right? Because there's a certain cost to moving data around, right? Both bandwidth and actual cost, right? And power and dollars to move stuff. And so if you have a camera observing wildlife migration in the woods, you don't want to keep all the images. You want to keep images where something moves, right? Or you want to keep images where these particular species you're looking at moves in a particular way, right? So that might be computing you'd want to deploy at the camera. You then eventually want to get that data back to a data center, right? That maybe is the full image, maybe it's a reduced version of the image because you processed it, and then take something from 1,000 weather stations or 1,000 stream sensors or 1,000 cameras in the woods and synthesize it into one big data set. That's going to happen at the core, right? Not out at the edge. Maybe we're training models in the data center so that you can identify something in that camera or on that car. So it's a lightweight compute task at the edge, but the heavyweight computing's already been done in the data center in advance, right? So how do you make the sort of energy trade-offs in what computes at the edge and what computes in the core is a sort of fascinating question at the moment that a lot of time and energy is going into. You mentioned quantum. That's sort of in the realm of, you know, next-gen computing technologies. Increasingly, it looks like quantum, at least in the relatively near term, will be a special purpose kind of computing, not a general purpose. I personally think we're still probably a couple of decades from general purpose quantum computers, but there may be in the next 5 to 10 years some corners of our application space where quantum can do a lot better. Cryptography is obviously the one everyone worries about, but there's a lot of things, particularly in material science. As turns out, to really understand how materials work, we have to study quantum phenomena. It turns out quantum phenomena work pretty well on quantum computers. I mean, they sort of naturally fit into that model. So when you're working at quantum scales, so you know, we'll probably see some quantum accelerators in the not terribly distant future. Most of what's out there now are still sort of development class machines, I would say. They're fascinating, but again, they're 1940s, 1950s computers. You can put them to a special purpose, and mostly you build them to learn more about computers, which turned out to be super important. So we ought to be doing that, right? Deploying and building some quantum machines. But their sort of use in science is probably, widespread use in science is probably still 5 to 10 years away, and being a general purpose is probably still a few decades away. But there's all sorts of technologies, neuromorphic, purpose-built AI chips that we're looking to exploit, you know, to do more broader kinds of scientific computing, just the way we grabbed GPUs to do scientific computing way back when. That is a sort of constantly ongoing process of looking at what the silicon communities are building.
Dr. Stanzione, thank you for speaking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here as always.
You've been listening to Dan Stanzione of Tech. Supersized Science is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world, brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the host, not of the University of Texas at Austin. For the Texas Advanced Computing Center, I'm Jorge Salazar.